And now it is my joy to introduce our speaker this morning. The Reverend Catherine Jesch, whom you've just met, is a community minister affiliated with First Unitarian Church in Portland, primarily focusing on environmental and social justice issues in that congregation and in the larger community. She serves on the leadership team of the Social Justice Council and works with the Community for Earth and the Immigrant Justice Action Groups of First Church. She is also coordinating the environmental justice campaign for Oregon Unitarian Universalist Voices for Justice, our statewide action network, focusing on climate change legislation in Oregon and protecting the rights of frontline communities in a just energy transition. Let's give a warm welcome to Catherine as she speaks to us this morning about environmental justice, a Unitarian Universalist response to the changing climate.
Good morning. It's really good to be with you this morning. That hymn we just sang was really uplifting, wasn't it? Not so much. I was reluctant to use that particular hymn. It's so depressing. But you know, it truly expresses how many of us feel when we think about our current situation in the world. And it's in a style of the venerable religious tradition of lamentation. Job did this when he was complaining about all that was going wrong with his life. Through no fault of his own, he thought. But a lot was going on for him. In the book of Job, we learn of his troubles. The oxen were plowing, and the donkeys were feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans, they were the others, fell on them and carried them off and killed the servants. And several more pages of how awful it was followed that. He was so distraught that he cried, "Let the day perish in which I was born. Let the day be darkness. Why did I not die at birth?" At that, God chastised him for complaining. But Job responds with his justification. "My troubles are so great," he cries. "What have I done wrong? Everything I am complaining about is true. Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak out of the anguish of my spirit. I will give free utterance to my soul." We do the same in our lamentations. "There is a blight upon the mountain," we just sang. "There is a sickness in the evening sky." I think it's important, if we don't get too carried away, that is. By acknowledging our despair, we energize ourselves so we can get to work repairing the world. Lamentation also encourages us to create a vision of an alternative world so we know where we're headed. "Let the ocean be as sweet as in the old days when the mountain stood alone." But before we reach that vision, that sweetness of the ocean, we must listen to the thunder and sound a warning through the wilderness. We must take action to reach environmental justice. So what is environmental justice? I'll start my thoughts about that definition with this excerpt from a December opinion piece in the New York Times written by Drew Dellinger, a spoken word poet and activist. And this echoes Martin Luther King's words that we began that responsive reading with. "We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied to a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly." Dillinger writes, 50 years ago on Christmas Eve, 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. stood in his pulpit at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta and told the congregation that in order to achieve peace on earth, we must develop a world perspective, a vision for the entire planet. "Yes," he said, As nations and individuals, we are interdependent. Then, and that was before we had our seven principles. Then, with a sentence that could easily have been written or uttered by John Muir and Rachel Carson, Dr. King stated, "It really boils down to this, that all life is interrelated." Dr. King's work to dismantle white supremacy and economic injustice was rooted in his prophetic Christianity, shaped by the black tradition, the social gospel, and the black freedom struggle. Less known is his understanding of all existence as unified and the voice he gave to a cosmology of connection. That's the end of the quote. I was surprised when I read that. It makes me wonder where Dr. King would have taken that insight had he lived even a few more years instead of just a few months. But in his last couple of years, his writings and speeches revealed that he was increasingly connecting his vision of justice and peace to the interrelated structure of the universe, what we Unitarian Universalists call the interdependent web of all existence. Again, quoting Dillinger, 50 years later, so many of our challenges represent a failure to understand our interconnectedness. White supremacists and neo-Nazis, emboldened in these times, preach a time-worn hatred that corrodes community. Corporate capitalism, with its widening gulf between the ultra-rich and the millions living in poverty, strains our social fabric. While the worsening climate crisis provides unforgiving reminders of the Earth's delicate interrelatedness. "This is our faith," Dr. King told his church on that December morning. "As we continue to hope for peace on Earth," he went on, "let us know that in the process we have cosmic companionship." I think the kind of companionship Dr. King means is that deep intertwining of the roots that hold us together in community, the beloved community we are reaching for. We are not individuals standing alone. We depend on being part of the whole. The Native American belief that what we do to the earth, we do to each other, is a fundamental tenet of our faith. A decade ago, when I was preaching about the Green Sanctuary Program, and I did that here in this room in 2006, I talked about how our environmental commitment was much more than the seventh principle. But I still had a lot to learn about the social dimensions of environmental justice. In 2009, my last assignment for the Unitarian Universalist Ministry for Earth was to write a guidebook for environmental justice. What is it, and how do you use Make It Happen? In that project, I tried to synthesize what others were saying: academics, federal agencies, secular organizations, the national people of color environmental leadership, and especially religious groups. By then, Unitarian Universalists had also made several public statements on the environment that I pulled into the mix. But really, we said nothing more than most secular groups had been saying for years. I was looking for a definition that fits with our principles and would be useful to those trying to work toward environmental justice in our congregations across the country. Here's what I came up with. Environmental justice is the human affirmation of our place within the interdependent web of all existence. Environmental justice is the practice of simultaneously protecting natural systems and the ecological health of human communities, especially communities of the poor, minorities, and indigenous peoples. There's lots of explanation and several conditions that follow that definition, but that is the core statement. I felt at the time, though, that something was missing. But now, nearly a decade later, I'm beginning to understand what it was that bothered me. This statement doesn't carry our theological weight. and it just isn't that compelling. Its academic tone works against the sense of urgency that we know we must respond to. My 2009 start only took what the secular world was saying and added the interdependent web phrase. I liked the tone of the religious language from the Christian tradition, but I couldn't use much from their statements because they didn't fit with my or our Unitarian Universalist theology. One of these days, maybe I'll rewrite it. But for today, the central message about environmental justice that I want to get across is about the many dimensions of equity within the interdependent web. It's not exactly equal one person to another. The inequities that exist across society translate into vulnerabilities for individuals and communities in the face of injustice. For most of us, the extensive and multiplier effects of our way of life have on other people and other species lie largely outside of our field of vision. Environmental justice calls us to become more aware of how individuals and communities are impacted and to respond to the injustice by using the benefits and privileges we have to mitigate injustice for others. Our current UU emphasis on trying to dismantle white supremacy and inequitable power structures is leading us to examine our own advocacy strategies, who we listen to when we are deciding what policies to support and which to object to, who do we partner with, and how do we share leadership. Climate change, climate disruption, climate chaos, whatever you call it, provides a perfect case study for environmental justice. Climate is a complex and interrelated pattern of atmospheric and hydraulic systems influenced by air and water circulation, geological phenomena such as volcanoes and dust storms, and by many other factors, both subtle and grand. That's the science of it. There are also direct human influences, including land development, habitat modifications, wildfires, air pollution, agricultural practices. The list is long. Some of these are well understood, while others remain mysterious. Though no being on the planet can escape the impacts of climate change, their severity will vary in place and time. The past year has offered us a good preview of the destructiveness we can anticipate going forward. Record-breaking hurricanes, floods, droughts, wildfires, and severe winter storms. Islanders in the South Pacific are already experiencing a rise in sea level that threatens to drown their whole nations within the next couple of decades. Native villagers in remote Alaskan settlements on the coast of the Bering Sea are seeing their cliffs crumble with the onslaught of higher waves, while their homes no longer have solid foundations because the permafrost is melting. From Hurricane Katrina to Superstorm Sandy, and last summer's trifecta of hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria, we can clearly see who bears the scars. But as humans, we can't fix the problem of climate change by ourselves, or even by joining one group or another. It takes a movement, and that movement is gaining strength as we speak. We have begun to recognize that climate change is a symptom of our disconnection from the natural world, as well as from the vulnerable communities in our own country. As Joanna Macy, that great teacher and mentor of environmental activists, has said, the problem is separation. We separate ourselves from our own self, from our own internal hopes and dreams, from our foibles and inadequacies, denying who we are as humans. That's what arrogance is. We also separate ourselves from each other, from those who are different from us, who believe differently, who make us uncomfortable. And ultimately, we separate ourselves from the whole of the world. We break the covenant with our seventh principle. In some traditions, this mindset of separation would be called a sin. We also separate the issues themselves, each into its own box. Prison reform here, racism there, immigration over there, and for many of us, climate change right here in front of us. This will never solve the problem. In addressing climate change, we must recognize all of these sins as a whole, as symptoms of the larger problem of our culture and our worldview. Our worldview of separation and the concentration of power with the elite that leaves everyone else by the wayside. In the end of the story about Job, it was his arrogance that God was bringing to his attention, his taking for granted the goodness of life. There's a whole section of the story in which God reminds him that he's only human. Can you draw out the Leviathan with a hook? And any hope of capturing it would be disappointed. No one is so fierce as to stir it up. Job is humbled by that thought, but the lamentation was still valid. And in speaking of what had gone wrong, he was gaining courage to confront the sources of his troubles, both those people who would take away his blessings and the limitations within himself for taking them for granted. In the ancient world, it was an unknowable deity that caused Job's personal tribulations. In today's world, we understand the actual causes much better and can begin to repair the damage. Now, we must recognize that we, puny little humans as we are, cannot tackle the whole Leviathan by ourselves. We must understand the big picture and connect with those addressing the other parts of it while we work on the part we feel called to address. Martin Luther King Jr. preached about the ills of pollution and Vietnam War, all while he was leading the movement for civil rights and anti-racism. The same laws that gave civil rights to black people make civil rights available to Muslims and GLBT folk. The same policies that support economic equality help immigrants, all poor people, youth, and all of the rest of us. The attitude that we're all in this together demands a generosity of spirit and an openness to the other that makes possible the creation of the world we see in our dreams. We truly are all in this together. The world needs Unitarian Universalism now more than ever. Not that we want to convert everyone, like the evangelists we love to complain about, but we need to bring to the world those values we hold at the core, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, of every being in this world, justice, equity, and compassion, and of course, respect for the interdependent web of all existence, of which we are a part. The world needs us to bring these values into the public square, proclaiming them as loudly and even more coherently than those who would continue to promote the opposite values, which have led us to this point in history. So what are we called to do? Here in Oregon, we're at the threshold of potentially game-changing legislation for our state. We've been talking about how to control carbon emissions for many years, but there was little broad-based support for a comprehensive solution. Then last year, the legislature finally had a bill ready to introduce, but the financial crisis of a $6 billion shortfall in our state sort of took the wind out of the sails. It was set aside to pick up this year during the 2018 short session, instead of risking outright rejection last year in the face of other pressing issues. A good strategy, I think. I hope. So it's 2018 now, and time to put our money where our mouth is. A bipartisan committee has been hard at work since last fall to craft a credible deal. And just last week, they finally released the results of their efforts. The legislative concept for both the House and the Senate are ready to introduce on starting day in just over a week from now. Let the games begin. The bill would put a price on carbon, that is a tax, added at the source of products distributed in Oregon that result in carbon emissions. This tax would be a market incentive to reduce emissions. There are certainly challenges in this approach, not the least of which is that increased costs would certainly impact those with less means to pay. There is also the challenge of distributing the revenues that result from this tax. An across-the-board tax rebate to all taxpayers is the default position to most who consider this type of solution. But that wouldn't do a thing to provide infrastructure to minimize the demand of fossil fuels. What we need is a way to fund that infrastructure. And by the way, low-income people need good-paying jobs so they can pay their fuel bills. This bill would create a fund specifically to connect people needing jobs to a program for installing that infrastructure we need so badly. Now, surely, this minimal description will pique your interest. I'm not going to detail how this would all happen. That's a technical presentation, not a sermon. But you do have two activists here in the congregation who have been tracking this proposal since the beginning of drafting last year's bill, maybe even before that. Evan Pierce and Don Merrick will be offering a presentation on those details after the service. You also need to know that it is critical to get something done about the climate. See, I put that in capital letters in my text. But it's not a done deal yet. There's plenty of opposition by the usual suspects, of course, and we'll see more of it as next November, or as the session draws to a close. But some of those legislators we might expect to be supportive have also expressed concerns and haven't yet committed their vote. That means they're still open to be swayed in either direction. We can't let them off the hook. And we'll need all of us, white, middle class, and frontline communities, to hold their feet to the fire and call them to account. Therefore, you need to let your legislators know what you think. Evan and Don will have information about the House and Senate bills. They will also have postcards for you to write a passage, a message to your legislators, and they can look up who that is if you don't know. That's a really easy task, so please don't pass up the opportunity for this small action. If you're not quite ready to make up your mind, ask questions and find out enough information so you can decide soon. Then let your legislators know what you think. The legislative session starts next week. Time's up. There's a lot going on around climate. And it all requires the watchful eyes of people committed to environmental justice to ensure that the needs and concerns of vulnerable communities are heard and responded to. If they win, we all win. Lamentation is useful, but now it's time to get busy. There's much to do. Let us come together within our own communities and with those beyond our walls. Let us repair our covenant with the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. We can help to ensure environmental justice for all and be a part of healing the world. May it be so, and may we make it so. Amen.